Ukrainian insurgent army. It was made up of ultra-nationalist Ukrainians, including Nazi collaborators, who wreaked havoc in the region, assisting in or directly carrying out the murder of thousands of Jews, Soviets, and Poles, and occasionally also fighting the Germans, who opposed OUNB's plan for a separate Ukrainian state. In 1944, Lebed helped form the Supreme Ukrainian Liberation Council, UHVR, which served as the organization's political arm. At the end of the war, Lebed fled to Rome and contacted the Allies. The U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps started working with him in 1947 and smuggled him to Munich, where he began collaborating with the CIA the following year. In June 1949, the CIA brought him to the United States. When the Justice Department later tried to deport him, Alan Dulles claimed he was of inestimable value to this agency and was assisting in operations of the first importance. Among those operations, Wisner's special projects, was one masterminded by Munich-based CIA officer Steve Tanner, who, in late 1948, started working with the UHVR. The following year, he readied operatives to infiltrate back into Ukraine. On September 5, 1949, the CIA parachuted the first of its Ukrainian agents back into the country. The operation continued for another 5 years but had little success. Although the Soviets made quick work of most of the infiltrators, such operations clearly signaled the lengths to which the U.S. was willing to go to dislodge Soviet control in Eastern Europe. The Soviets tightened their grip. The last remaining non-communists had already been driven out of the Bulgarian and Czechoslovakian administrations. Czechoslovakian Foreign Minister Jan Masaryk's manner of death, falling or being pushed out of his bathroom window, would come to haunt Forrestal. After Soviet imposition of a puppet regime in Czechoslovakia, relations between the Soviet Union and the United States froze over. The brutal Eastern European dictatorships would last another 4 decades. The CIA's first covert operation involved subverting Italy's 1948 election, thus ensuring a Christian democratic victory over the communists. In that case, as in many throughout the post-World War II era, the U.S. commitment to democracy went only so far. Kennan told Marshall that a communist victory would undermine our whole position in the Mediterranean. He preferred to see the Italian government outlaw the Communist Party and precipitate a violent civil war, giving the United States an excuse to intervene militarily. Nor was democracy a major consideration when the CIA took over responsibility for running the Gehlen organization in Germany from the U.S. Army. General Reinhard Gehlen, a former Nazi who had run intelligence in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union for Hitler, recruited a network of Nazi war criminals drawn in part from the Sicherheitsdienst, SD, Gestapo, and Waffen-SS. The Gehlen Org, as it was known, provided extensive intelligence on Eastern Europe, always painting the worst possible picture of Soviet actions and threats. A retired CIA official acknowledged, "The agency loved Gehlen because he fed us what we wanted to hear. We used his stuff constantly, and we fed it to everybody else. The Pentagon, the White House, the newspapers. They loved it too. But it was hyped up Russian boogeyman junk, and it did a lot of damage to this country." At war's end, U.S. policymakers decided not to allow their booming military-industrial machine to erode. In 1948, 62% of all federal research and development was military-related. The Air Force claimed a large share. General Carl Spatz testified before Congress that the next war will be preponderantly an air war. The United States began missile research, employing many of the hundreds of scientists it had secreted out of Germany, including almost the entirety of Wernher von Braun's rocket staff at Peenemünde. Some of the scientists had been involved in human experimentation and Nazi slave labor programs. Equally disturbing, during the Tokyo war criminal trials, U.S. authorities secretly granted blanket immunity to Japanese officers and researchers involved with the notorious Unit 731 in exchange for sharing the results of lethal experiments conducted on 3,000 prisoners in Manchuria. Meanwhile, the Air Force, competing with the Army and the Navy over funding and prestige, employed its own in-house think tank to design strategies that would promote the Air Force's primacy. In 1948, this division transformed itself into the independent RAND Corporation. During these years, U.S. war plans became increasingly reliant on atomic weapons and air warfare, which were determined to be far cheaper than conventional military forces. By the middle of the next decade, the Air Force would consume nearly as much of the defense budget as the Army and Navy combined. The evolution of U.S. military strategy enhanced the strategic importance of the Middle East. By 1947, U.S. war plans called for U.S. air attacks on Soviet targets from bases in the Middle East, Okinawa, and Britain. Of particular importance was the base at Cairo Suez, from which U.S. bombers could reach 84% of Soviet oil refining capacity. As part of this strategy, the United States bolstered its military capabilities in Turkey, enhancing that country's ability to impede a Soviet offensive in the region. 1948 was also the year that the Israeli-Palestinian issue came to a head, in a way that would plague U.S. policy for the next six decades plus. The situation was complicated by the fact that, despite the Procrustean efforts of U.S. policymakers, Middle East issues never fit neatly into the Cold War paradigm. U.S. policymakers tried to navigate among a number of constituencies with fundamentally different interests. Reactionary Arab leaders who controlled vast oil resources, as well as strategic bases and routes in the region. Nationalist Arab masses, often living in squalid conditions. Palestinian victims of Israeli policy. Jewish victims of the Holocaust, who had been desperate for a homeland. Jewish and later conservative voters in the United States, including Christian evangelicals, who staunchly defended Israeli actions, and a united Islamic world that opposed Israeli policy and sometimes the very existence of a Jewish state in their midst. The problem had already taken form while the region was under British control. In 1915, using their usual divide-and-conquer strategy, the British promised the Arabs an independent state in order to foment an Arab rebellion against the Ottoman Empire. Then, in 1917, Arthur Balfour, Britain's Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, pledged support for a Jewish homeland in Palestine, which was home to 750,000 Arabs and 65,000 Jews. Arthur Kessler described this as one nation promising another nation the land of a third nation. At Versailles, in 1919, the delegates ratified the Balfour Declaration, giving Great Britain a mandate over Palestine. In 1922, the U.S. Congress also ratified the declaration. In the early years of the century, European Jews looking to relocate typically chose the United States, not Palestine, to which only 3% of European Jews emigrated prior to the 1930s. 68% went to the United States. But Jewish emigration to the United States was sharply curtailed by the Restrictive Immigration Acts of 1921 and 1924. During the 1930s, Jews fleeing Nazi persecution raised the number of Jewish emigres to Palestine substantially, angering the Arab inhabitants. Arab attacks on Jewish settlers increased as the Jewish population climbed to 500,000, or 30% of the total population. Jews retaliated in kind. Roosevelt vacillated in his support for a Jewish homeland, not wanting to alienate the Saudis, whom the United States was courting for their oil, and wishing to gain a foothold in the Middle East to compete with Great Britain. He made contradictory comments to Jews and Arabs. On his way back from Yalta, he met with Saudi King Ibn Saud and was surprised by the depths of his opposition to a Jewish homeland. Saud told him to establish a Jewish homeland in Germany. Amends should be made by the criminal, not by the innocent bystander. Roosevelt reversed his earlier commitments and promised Saud that he would do nothing to assist the Jews against the Arabs and make no move hostile to the Arab people. He also did little to help Jews escape from Nazi persecution. He was hindered by a State Department that was insensitive to the tragic plight of Jewish victims. Even after early 1942, when word began to filter out about the Nazi extermination policies, the United States admitted only 160,000 European Jews between 1933 and 1942, increasing the Jewish population only from 3.6 to 3.7% of the overall U.S. population. At war's end, the British still dominated the area, with 200,000 troops at their Suez Canal base, air bases in Iraq and Sudan, and air installations at Lydda in Palestine, naval bases in Bahrain and Aden, and a naval presence in Haifa, and command of the 8,000-strong Arab League in Transjordan. Determined to do nothing that would further antagonize the Arabs and jeopardize British interests, including oil from Iraq and Iran, they continued Neville Chamberlain's 1939 policy of restricting and then halting Jewish immigration. That did not, however, staunch the flow of Holocaust survivors and other Jewish emigres streaming illegally into Palestine after the war. When the British cracked down, arresting more than 2,000 Jews, the Jewish terrorist organization Irgun retaliated by bombing the British Secretariat and military headquarters at the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, leaving 91 people dead. In mid-1946, Truman decided to back a plan that would allow 100,000 European refugees to emigrate to Palestine, but instead of creating a separate Jewish state, would establish a single state with separate Jewish and Arab provinces. Jewish leaders were adamantly opposed to the plan. Truman devoted a cabinet lunch to discussing the Palestine problem. Acheson and Forrestal urged Truman to go forward with the plan. Henry Wallace was opposed. Wallace's diary entry sheds light on the discussion and Truman's attitude. President Truman expressed himself as being very much put out with the Jews. He said that Jesus Christ couldn't please them when he was here on earth, so how could anyone expect that I would have any luck? Truman said that he had no use for them and didn't care what happened to them. Wallace reminded him, "You must remember that it is easy for them to get into quite a state of mind, because nearly all the Jews in the country have relatives in Europe, and they know that about 5 million out of the 6 million Jews have been killed, and that no other people have suffered in this way." Wallace wrote, "Jim Forrestal had previously undertaken to say that the Poles had suffered more than the Jews. Forrestal brought up the question of the oil in Saudi Arabia, and said if another war came along we would need the oil in Saudi Arabia. President Truman said he wanted to handle this problem not from the standpoint of bringing in oil, but from the standpoint of what is right." In early 1947, Great Britain announced that, along with its retrenchment in Greece and Turkey, it would terminate its mandate over Palestine and refer the problem to the United Nations without recommending a solution. In May, the Soviets surprised U.S. officials when Deputy Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko unfurled the Soviet position before the U.N. General Assembly. Citing the horrors of the Holocaust, the fact that both Jews and Arabs had historical claims to the land, and the ways in which British malfeasance had exacerbated tensions between them, Gromyko said the Soviets preferred a binational or federal state. However, if that weren't possible, they would support a two-state solution, which the Jewish militants greatly preferred and the Arabs adamantly opposed. In late 1947, the United Nations, despite fierce Arab opposition, endorsed the partition of Palestine into two independent states. The Soviets supported the solution. The British and the Arabs opposed it, and the United States equivocated but finally came on board. Arab violence flared in Palestine as soon as the partition vote was announced. On May 14, 1948, the State of Israel proclaimed its existence. 11 minutes later, the United States offered diplomatic recognition. Hours later, the Arab nations launched a full-scale war, hoping to eliminate the new nation before it got off the ground. Relying heavily on Soviet and Czech weapons, the badly outnumbered Israelis defeated the Arabs in the initial six-month war. In recognizing Israel, Truman defied the advice of Marshall, Forrestal, and Lovett, who feared a break with U.S. oil-producing friends in the region. They also feared losing U.S. and British access to Middle Eastern bases from which to attack the Soviet Union if war broke out. During a meeting in the Oval Office on May 12th, Clifford had laid out the moral and strategic case for recognition. He envisioned Israel as an invaluable U.S. ally in a volatile region. Marshall vehemently countered Clifford's arguments and insisted that they were based on domestic political considerations, Truman's hope of winning the Jewish vote. Marshall bluntly told Truman that if Truman recognized Israel, he would not vote for him in the 1948 presidential election. There was some truth to Marshall's contention. Truman was certainly aware of the domestic political implications of his actions. "In all of my political experience," he told a friend, "I don't ever recall the Arab vote swinging a close election." And Truman was in a very close election in 1948, one in which every vote counted. But Truman, despite his frequent anti-Semitic comments and contempt for Jewish activists, was also motivated by a sincere concern for Jews suffering in the Holocaust. Marshall had advocated a trusteeship over Palestine under UN auspices that would keep Jews and Arabs in the same country. He and the others also worried about the close ties between Israel and the Soviet Union, whose legal recognition of Israel had followed closely behind that of the United States on May 15th. U.S. intelligence reported Soviet influence with the Irgun and the Stern Gang, and took note of the influx of Jewish communists into the region. The United States and Great Britain, trying not to antagonize the Arabs completely, placed an embargo on arms shipments to both sides, and the United States maneuvered to preempt UN resolutions condemning Arab aggression. U.S. policymakers, fearing Soviet military intervention either unilaterally or as part of an international peacekeeping force, pushed for a quick resolution. Despite Ibn Saud's threats to cancel the concession to Aramco, which Texaco and Standard Oil of California had established in Saudi Arabia, the United States was not overly concerned about Arab retaliation. An early July State Department report found that, excluding Iran, the Middle East supplied only 6% of Western oil supplies, and that the loss could be absorbed without substantial hardship to any group of consumers. Although Israel signed armistice agreements with Egypt, Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria in 1949, the Arabs' bitterness over the creation of a Jewish state in the Middle East persists to this day, and the issues that caused the 1948 war remain unresolved. The situation was exacerbated by a massive refugee problem, as many Arabs fled from what would become Israel, some following the advice of Arab leaders, and some driven out by the Israelis. The refugee problem, after more than 60 years, remains a constant source of tension in the region. While Arabs and Israelis fought in the Middle East, the United States and the Soviet Union almost came to blows over Germany. In spring 1948, the United States and Britain took preliminary steps toward carving out a separate West German government, overcoming the reluctance of France and other Western European nations that feared a powerful, potentially remilitarized nation. Many German politicians in the Western zones were also resistant to this development, fearing the severance of economic, political, and personal ties to Eastern Germany. In late June, the United States boldly and provocatively instituted currency reform in the three Western sectors of occupied Berlin, which was 100 miles inside the Soviet zone. Seeing this as not only a major step in establishing an independent, remilitarized West German state only 3 years after the defeat of Hitler, but as a betrayal of the U.S. promise to provide desperately needed reparations from the more prosperous Western zones, the Soviets cut off rail and road access to Berlin. Stalin maintained that Western access had been based on wartime agreements establishing a quadripartite Allied Control Commission as the supreme authority for a unified Germany. Because the Western powers were now shattering that framework, he reasoned, they had forfeited access rights. Western observers decried the savage cruelty of the Soviets' Berlin blockade. The commandant of the American sector of Berlin, Fran Howley, described it as a comprehensive criminal plan to shut off the eastern zone of Germany from the west and to isolate completely the three western sectors of Berlin. It was, Howley charged, a wicked decision, the most barbarous in history since Genghis Khan. The Soviets, Western leaders screamed, were trying to starve West Berliners into submission. Images of Soviet cruelty would be seared into global consciousness, a perception of the crisis that still persists today. But, contrary to this widely held view, the Soviets, for all their faults, attempted nothing of the sort. They had, in fact, gone out of their way to guarantee West Berliners access to food and coal from the Eastern Zone, or from direct Soviet provisions. In October 1948, U.S. military government intelligence analysts reported the road, rail, and water blockade of Berlin by no means constitutes a complete economic blockade, either by intent or in fact. What people do remember, however, is that over the next 11 months, the United States airlifted 1.6 million tons of food and fuel into West Berlin to feed 2.2 million people. Truman also sent 60 presumably atomic-capable B-29s to British and German bases. He assured Forrestal that if conditions warranted it, he would approve the use of atomic weapons. "We are very close to war," he wrote in September. When Forrestal asked Kennan for his analysis of the Soviet blockade, Kennan offered the most alarming assessment. "Communist ideology and Soviet behavior clearly demonstrate that the ultimate objective of the leaders of the USSR is the domination of the world." And despite knowing the risks, the United States prolonged the crisis until it achieved both a basic law outlining the West German state and the creation in April 1949 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, which committed the United States for the first time in its history to a peacetime military alliance with Western Europe. In May 1949, having won its objectives, the United States agreed to talks over the future of Germany, and it was only then that the Soviet Union lifted the blockade, ending the most dangerous post-war confrontation to date. The United States had gambled that its atomic monopoly would enable it to achieve its goals without having to go to war, and it won. Once out of office, Henry Wallace assumed the editorship of the liberal New Republic and continued to criticize Truman's policies. On December 29, 1947, he announced that he was going to take his fight for peace one step farther and challenge Truman in the 1948 presidential elections. "Thousands of people all over the United States have asked me to engage in this great fight," he declared. "The people are on the march. We have assembled a Gideon's army, small in number, powerful in conviction, ready for action. The people's peace will usher in the century of the common man." The bigger the peace vote in 1948, the more definitely the world will know that the United States is not behind the bipartisan reactionary war policy, which is dividing the world into two armed camps and making inevitable the day when American soldiers will be lying in their Arctic suits in the Russian snow. To deal with the Wallace challenge, Clifford suggested that Truman adopt a progressive strategy on social and economic issues, ignore left-wing attacks on his foreign policy, and let others handle the job of discrediting Wallace. Clifford wrote, "Every effort must be made to identify and isolate him in the public mind with the communists. The administration must persuade prominent liberals and progressives, and no one else, to move publicly into the fray. They must point out that the core of the Wallace backing is made up of communists and fellow travelers." Red-baiting began almost immediately, and was almost entirely conducted by people clearly identified with the liberal camp. They accused Wallace and the Progressive Party of being tools of Moscow. Truman could not refrain from joining the chorus. "I do not want and I will not accept the support of Henry Wallace and his communists," he told those attending a St. Patrick's Day dinner. Wallace repeatedly denied any involvement with the Communist Party USA and warned that charges of anti-communism were being used to undermine American freedoms. This proved to be of little avail. Mobs broke up Wallace rallies. Wallace groups were banned from campuses. Universities denied Wallace the right to speak on campus, and his supporters were sometimes fired from their jobs. The Pittsburgh Press published the names, addresses, and places of employment of more than 1,000 people in the western part of the state who had signed Wallace nominating petitions. Wallace's running mate, Senator Glenn Taylor of Idaho, was arrested and beaten up by the police in Birmingham, Alabama, for defying a municipal ordinance banning integrated meetings and adding insult to injury by entering the gathering of the Southern Negro Youth Congress through a door marked colored. Wallace wired Taylor, "This dramatizes the hypocrisy of spending billions for arms in the name of defending freedom abroad, while freedom is trampled on here at home." The red-baiting, the dismissive treatment of Wallace by the major newspapers, Truman's move to the left on domestic issues, and a last-minute rush to Truman by Democratic voters who feared a victory by Republican Thomas Dewey, resulted in an electoral disaster for the Wallace campaign. Gallup showed Wallace polling at 7% in early 1948. Some observers predicted that he would win more than 10 million voters. Wallace predicted 3 to 5 million. In October, he was polling at 4%. The final tally had him coming in fourth, with 1,157,063 votes, almost 12,000 votes behind Dixiecrat Strom Thurmond. In the end, he totaled only 2.38% of the national vote. The Wall Street Journal put an interesting spin on the impact of the campaign, editorializing, "It is said by political commentators that Mr. Wallace made a bad showing because he got few votes. What they neglect is that Mr. Wallace succeeded in having his ideas adopted, except in the field of foreign affairs. From the time that Mr. Wallace announced he would run for president, Mr. Truman began to suck the wind from Mr. Wallace's sails by coming out for more and more of the Wallace domestic program." But on the issues most central to the Wallace campaign, which would change the way the United States operated in the world, American voters backed the candidate who had driven the nation down the path of empire, nuclear arms race, and global confrontation. It was a sad final chapter to a storied political career by a man who never fit the mold of U.S. politicians, but who espoused a moral vision of the role an enlightened United States could play in the world. In a top-secret 1948 memo, George Kennan outlined the dilemma facing U.S. policymakers, making clear why Wallace's alternatives were dismissed with such contempt. "We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. We cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreamings. We should cease to talk about vague and unreal objectives, such as human rights, the raising of the living standards, and democratization. We are going to have to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are then hampered by idealistic slogans, the better." Successful resolution of the Berlin crisis and the establishment of NATO in 1949 temporarily raised Westerners' spirits, but two colossal setbacks reversed that momentum. First, the Chinese Communist Party, under Mao Zedong, routed Zhang Zhexi's Kuomintang and seized power in the world's largest and most populous nation. The New York Times described the communist victory as a vast tragedy of unforeseeable consequences for the Western world. And by the end of the year, the Times concluded, The developments in China represent a startling defeat for the traditional Far Eastern policy of the United States, and an equally startling victory for Soviet Russia. Losing the world's most populous nation to communism represented such a reversal of fortune that some saw it as the beginning of the end for U.S. efforts in Asia. Major General Claire Chennault, the former head of the Flying Tigers, predicted a third and more horrible world war if the United States permits communism to conquer China. We will make a billion enemies. Chinese leaders feared U.S. military action. Republicans blamed Truman for losing China and demanded stronger support for Zhang. Though the American public was caught off guard, top U.S. officials had long anticipated a communist victory, due more to Zhang's incompetence and corruption than to Mao's brilliance. As Truman noted, "We picked a bad horse." Zhang's administration, he said, was one of the most corrupt and inefficient that ever made an attempt to govern a country. Zhang was sent scurrying to set up shop in Taiwan, where U.S. officials expected a communist takeover within a year. More concerned about their own immediate security than the world revolution, the Soviets had provided little assistance and less encouragement to the Chinese communists. Even though Mao and Stalin formed an alliance in February 1950, the Soviets urged Chinese communist leaders to maintain cordial relations with the United States, and trade between the two nations continued for several months. But China's commitment to revolutionary change and U.S. refusal to recognize the legitimacy of the new government doomed any efforts at rapprochement. On September 23, 1949, President Truman shocked the nation. "We have evidence that within recent weeks, an atomic explosion occurred in the USSR." Most scientists had anticipated this and took the news in stride. In early 1946, the Los Angeles Times cited testimony from the chemist Harold Urey and other scientists that the Soviets would have a bomb within 5 years to discredit Groves's assertion that it would take the Soviets another 20. Experts had long recognized that the challenge was an engineering, not a scientific one. The Times accused Groves of consigning the American people to a fool's paradise by promoting the fanciful notion that the United States had a secret worth preserving, and wisely urged U.S. authorities to use their 5 years of grace, not for piling up atom bombs and behaving like a dog in the manger, but for constructive statesmanship, a view widely shared by the scientists. In 1948, J. Robert Oppenheimer told Time magazine, "Our atomic monopoly is like a cake of ice melting in the sun." The Air Force had also just predicted that the Soviets would not test for years. Truman, who had earlier told Oppenheimer that the Soviets would never develop a bomb, initially disbelieved the reports of the Soviet test, and then credited German scientists working in the Soviet Union. Soviet scientists breathed a huge sigh of relief. Physicist Yuli Karaton commented, "In possessing such a weapon, we had removed the possibility of its being used against the USSR with impunity. The bomb, he felt, allowed our country to defend itself from really threatening mortal danger." Physicist Igor Golovin wrote that their sleepless nights and Herculean efforts had been worth it because they had knocked the trump card from the hands of the American atomic diplomats. Americans felt more vulnerable than ever. The bulletin of the atomic scientists moved the hands of the doomsday clock from 7 minutes to midnight to 3 minutes. Senate Majority Leader Scott Lucas feared that "we may be in the last stage of a great civilization, the final stage before the colossal war and the disintegration of society as we have known it in our lifetime." The New York Times wondered if anyone was rash enough today to say who is winning the Cold War. On the other hand, some people saw a silver lining. Journalist William Lawrence thought it reasonable to assume that the Soviets could produce a bomb per week and would, in 1 year, have 50 bombs capable of destroying 50 U.S. cities containing 40 million people. But he also thought that the Soviet Union's possessing the bomb might yield the long-awaited agreement for international control, because bargaining between equals was much more productive than bargaining between two decidedly unequal powers. Once again, hotter heads prevailed. Additional money poured into nuclear research and expanding the U.S. arsenal. Senator Brian McMahon, chair of the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, told David Lilienthal that the United States now had to blow the Soviets off the face of the earth, and quickly. James Forrestal did not live to see what for him would have been a thoroughly nightmarish development. The details of his death are still murky. For years, Forrestal had been as fierce an anti-communist as strode the corridors of the nation's capital. His views had helped shape the poisonous climate in Washington, in which the Truman administration repeatedly attributed the most damning motives to Soviet actions. Yet he had been on the losing end of several policy battles with Truman, including recognition of Israel, military versus civilian control of atomic bombs, defense spending, strengthening the German cartels, and arming Latin American countries. In October 1948, when Truman's prospects for re-election looked bleak, newspapers reported that Forrestal had reached out to Dewey, expressing his interest in remaining in the cabinet when Dewey became president. All of that boded poorly for his relationship with Truman. On March 1st, Truman asked for his resignation, leaving him shattered. He officially retired on March 28, 1949. The following day, an aide found him sitting at his desk, staring at the wall. He was sent to Hobe Sound, Florida, to be with his wife, who was visiting recently retired Undersecretary of State Robert Lovett. "Bob, they're after me," he told Lovett upon his arrival. Whether they referred to the Jews and Zionist agents he believed were trailing him, or the communists, was never specified. On April 2nd, the Navy flew Forrestal from Florida to the District of Columbia, where he was admitted into the Bethesda Naval Hospital, reportedly suffering from a nervous breakdown. Drew Pearson informed his radio audience that Forrestal was out of his mind after Forrestal was discovered in the street wearing his pajamas and shouting, "The Russians are coming." He believed that the Russians had invaded the United States. Pearson later reported that during his brief stay in Florida, Forrestal had attempted suicide four times by hanging, slashing his wrists, and taking sleeping pills. Communist countries milked the story of the Soviet-phobic Forrestal's mental travails for all it was worth. Washington Post columnist Marquis Childs described a five-column-wide May Day cartoon in Pravda with the caption, "Club Aggressors." The cartoon showed Forrestal in a straitjacket, lecturing to Winston Churchill, John Foster Dulles, and others. A hospital orderly restrains Forrestal, who crouches on all fours on a pedestal. An accompanying verse says that not the straitjacket, but the will of those who do not want war, is preventing Forrestal's freedom of action. The Polish communist paper Tribuna Ludu reported, "Insanity. Diagnosis. Persecution mania. Patient, James Forrestal, Minister of War of the United States, who resigned his post 2 weeks ago. Symptoms? A few days ago, upon hearing the siren of a fire truck passing his house, the patient rushed into the street in his underwear shouting, 'The Russians are invading the city.' The doctors declared that the patient had long been suffering from psychic disturbances, even when he was still fulfilling his official functions." The Polish paper cited Pearson's revelation that Truman had ordered a review of all of Forrestal's recent reports, recommendations, and decisions, wanting to ascertain whether Mr. Forrestal went mad under the pressure of Cold War propaganda, which he himself had carried on for years, or whether all that propaganda was the consequence of the insanity which had seized Mr. Forrestal a long time ago. Trying to downplay the seriousness of his condition, hospital officials placed him on the 16th floor instead of in the first floor mental ward to avoid suspicion. Alone in his room, he suffered constant nightmares. He thought he would suffer the same fate as Czechoslovakian Foreign Minister Jan Masaryk, to be pushed out of a window. but his condition began to improve, and on the night of May 22, 1949, he stayed up late copying Sophocles' The Chorus from Ajax, in which the hero ponders his fate far from home. At the word nightingale, he put his pen down and jumped. And in a bizarre, though oddly revealing, turn of events, the man who oversaw contact with Nightingale, as well as a plethora of other covert operations, Frank Wisner, would himself become infected with paranoia and psychosis. In 1965, after repeated institutionalizations and sustained electroshock therapy, Wisner blasted his own head off with a shotgun. On January 1, 1950, the world happily bade farewell to the 1940s. For the United States, the decade ended on a bitter note, with the communist triumph in China and the first Soviet atomic bomb test. Despite the immensity of U.S. power, the United States felt besieged by enemies at home and abroad. The optimism that had reigned just years earlier with the end of the war had given way to a new sense of fear and anxiety. Chapter 6. Eisenhower. A Not-So-Pretty Picture. On March 4, 1953, Americans woke to the news that Soviet Premier Joseph Stalin had been paralyzed by a cerebral hemorrhage. The 74-year-old dictator died the following day. Americans held their breath. The Soviets were in shock. Despite Stalin's extraordinary brutality, most of them revered him for having led the nation to victory over the Nazis and having turned the Soviet Union into a modern industrial state. While the public mourned, Soviet leaders secretly decided to ease tensions with the capitalist West so they could focus on improving conditions at home. Georgi Malenkov, Stalin's successor, speaking at Stalin's funeral, called for international cooperation and economic relations with all countries, a peace based on prolonged coexistence and peaceful competition between capitalism and socialism. The new Soviet leaders held out an olive branch. Would the United States' newly elected president, Dwight David Eisenhower, and his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, accept it? Following the end of World War II, the United States slowly built its stockpile of atom bombs, from 13 in mid-1947, only one of which could have been operational within 2 weeks, to 300 by mid-1950. At the same time, it enhanced its ability to deliver those bombs. The advent of the atomic age revolutionized strategic thinking. Air power would now reign supreme. The United States Air Force, USAF, became an independent service in 1947. One of the USAF's three units, the Strategic Air Command, SAC, assumed primary responsibility for delivering the new weapons. In 1948, Lieutenant General Curtis LeMay, the mastermind of the United States terror bombing of Japan, took charge of SAC and set out to turn it into a first-rate fighting force, one that would be ready to do battle against the Soviets at a moment's notice. "We are at war now," he declared. When fighting began, he intended to simply overwhelm Soviet defenses, dropping 133 atomic bombs on 70 cities, knocking out 40% of Soviet industry, and killing 2.7 million people. The SAC emergency war plan he designed called for delivery of the entire stockpile in a single massive attack. The Army and Navy both challenged the ethics of deliberately targeting civilians in this way, finding it antithetical to U.S. moral principles. But the Joint Chiefs of Staff sided with the Air Force and approved the plan in late 1948. Despite some misgivings, Truman went along with this decision, motivated in part by budgetary concerns. Reliance on atomic weapons was less costly than maintaining the level of conventional forces needed to defend the United States and Western Europe from potential Soviet aggression. A report commissioned by Secretary of Defense James Forrestal cast serious doubt upon U.S. prospects of defeating the Soviet Union based upon atomic warfare alone. The destruction caused would pale in comparison to the horrific levels of suffering the Soviets had sustained in the recent war. In fact, the committee warned, atomic bombardment would validate Soviet propaganda, stimulate resentment against the United States, unify these people, and increase their will to fight. It would also set the dangerous pattern for future use of any weapons of mass destruction. But by the time the study arrived, Forrestal was long gone, and his successor, Lewis Johnson, withheld the report from Truman. In August 1949, the USSR successfully tested an atomic bomb, delivering a crushing blow to the United States' sense of military superiority and invulnerability. The stunning news caught most U.S. war planners by surprise. Truman flatly disbelieved the evidence. Once convinced, he quickly approved plans to expand U.S. inventory of atomic bombs. The Joint Chiefs, supported by physicists Edward Teller, Ernest Lawrence, and Luis Alvarez, demanded development of a hydrogen or super bomb. Atomic Energy Commission, AEC, head David Lilienthal described scientific proponents as drooling with the prospect and bloodthirsty. In secret session, General James McCormick, director of the AEC's Division of Military Application, told members of Congress that the bomb would be infinite. You can have it any size up to the sun. Lilienthal and many of the leading scientists were appalled at the prospect. In October, the eight scientists on the General Advisory Committee to the AEC, headed by J. Robert Oppenheimer, unanimously opposed building the hydrogen bomb because its primary effect would be exterminating civilian populations. The majority considered it to be in a totally different category from an atomic bomb and might become a weapon of genocide. With its unlimited destructive capability, it would represent a threat to the future of the human race. Committee members Enrico Fermi and I.I. Rabi declared it to be a danger to humanity as a whole, an evil thing considered in any light. Among those vehemently opposed to building the hydrogen bomb was State Department Soviet expert George Kennan, who believed that the USSR might be ready for a comprehensive nuclear arms control agreement, and urged Secretary of State Dean Acheson to pursue that course instead. Acheson contemptuously suggested that Kennan resign from the Foreign Service, assume a monk's habit, carry a tin cup and stand on the street corner and say, "The end of the world is nigh." Disgusted by the increasingly militaristic bent of U.S. policy, Kennan resigned as State Department Director of Policy Planning on December 31, 1949. On January 31, 1950, Truman announced his decision to proceed with the hydrogen bomb. 2 weeks later, Albert Einstein appeared on Eleanor Roosevelt's television show to warn, "If these efforts should prove successful, radioactive poisoning of the atmosphere, and hence annihilation of all life on Earth, will have been brought within the range of what is technically possible." Physicist Leo Szilard soon delivered more terrifying news when he told a national radio audience that the fusion of 500 tons of deuterium in a hydrogen cobalt bomb would be enough to kill everybody on Earth. Such warnings took a tremendous toll on the human psyche. As writer William Faulkner observed in his December 1950 Nobel Prize acceptance speech, "Our tragedy today is a general and universal physical fear so long sustained by now that we can even bear it. There are no longer problems of the spirit. There is only one question. When will I be blown up?" Kennan's replacement, Forrestal's protege, Paul Nitzer, had been a vice president of the powerful Wall Street investment banking firm, Dillon Reed, when Forrestal was the firm's president. NHTSA immediately took the lead in preparing NSC 68, a document that would fundamentally revamp the nation's defense posture. NSC 68 posited that the Soviet Union, armed with atomic bombs and a new fanatic faith, was seeking to impose its absolute authority over the rest of the world. Faced with an existential threat, the United States had to base its response not on what the Soviet Union was likely to do, but on what, in its most malign moments, it was capable of doing. A. To overrun Western Europe, to drive toward the oil-bearing areas of the Near and Middle East, and to consolidate communist gains in the Far East. B. To launch air attacks against the British Isles, and air and sea attacks against the lines of communication of the Western powers in the Atlantic and the Pacific. C. To attack selected targets with atomic weapons, now including targets in Alaska, Canada, and the U.S. No area was outside the U.S. defense perimeter, because, as the document stated, the assault on free institutions is worldwide now, and a defeat of free institutions anywhere is a defeat everywhere. National security and global security were now one and the same. If the Soviet Union calculates that it has a sufficient atomic capability to make a surprise attack on us, nullifying our atomic superiority and creating a military situation decisively in its favor, the Kremlin might be tempted to strike swiftly and with stealth. Facing such a dangerous foe, NHTSA concluded, U.S. survival depended on vastly increasing its nuclear and conventional arsenals, strengthening its armed forces, bolstering its military alliances, and expanding its covert operations and psychological warfare capabilities. Over the next 5 years, military spending would have to quadruple to $50 billion, or 20% of GNP. Truman agreed with NSC 68's assessment of the overall strategic situation and endorsed its conclusions, but blanched at the cost, having already announced plans to cut defense spending in the next fiscal year. Acheson and NHTSA countered that quadrupling military spending would stimulate the economy and safeguard against another depression. The State Department's leading Soviet experts, George Kennan and Charles Bolin, opposed such a build-up, contending that Stalin had neither the will nor the means to pursue the kind of world conquest Acheson and NHTSA envisioned. Much to Acheson and NHTSA's disappointment, such a stupendous increase in military spending seemed dead in the water in early 1950. Escalating tensions abroad triggered a new onslaught of red-baiting at home. Truman's loyalty security program in 1947 had opened the door. Highly publicized charges of espionage and treason fed the hysteria. In January 1950, former State Department official Alger Hiss, who had been relentlessly pursued by Congressman Richard Nixon, was convicted of perjury. Later that month, physicist Klaus Fuchs was apprehended for passing nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union. Fuchs divulged the existence of a wider spy ring, which led to the arrests in July of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. In February 1950, little-known Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy gained notoriety by telling members of the Ohio County Women's Republican Club in Wheeling, West Virginia, "I have here in my hand a list of 205, a list of names that were made known to the Secretary of State as being members of the Communist Party, and who, nevertheless, are still working and shaping policy in the State Department." The next day, in Salt Lake City, he lowered the number to 57. Though his numbers continued to fluctuate, he garnered headlines with outlandish accusations that provoked a new round of high-profile hearings. His victims included State Department Asia experts, accused of assisting Mao's victory in China. Their ouster would cripple U.S. understanding of Asia for decades to come. Though the shamelessly self-promoting Wisconsin senator, known mockingly as Tail Gunner Joe for his fabricated war exploits, became the ugly face of this repression, The real power was exercised by FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, who kept a file of incriminating evidence on members of Congress, which he trotted out when it was necessary to keep someone in line. One of Hoover's top aides described how this worked. The other night we picked up a situation where this senator was seen drunk in a hit-and-run accident, and some good-looking broad was with him. By noon of the next day, the good senator was aware that we had the information, and we never had any trouble with him on appropriations since. Officials and the media cautioned Americans that vicious, fanatical communists bent on destroying the American way of life lurked around every corner. Truman's attorney general warned, "There are today many communists in America. They are everywhere, in factories, offices, butcher stores, on street corners, in private business." And indeed, scientists, writers, actors, directors, artists, teachers, and people from all walks of life were persecuted for their political beliefs as a climate of fear descended upon the nation. A few hundred people served time in prison, and as many as 12,000 may have lost their jobs. After they failed political screenings administered by the Coast Guard, almost 3,000 longshoremen and seamen alone were dismissed under a port security program, allegedly implemented to defend the nation's waterfronts from saboteurs during the Korean War, but actually designed to wipe out the communist-led maritime unions. Many suspects were hauled before congressional committees, where investigators demanded they finger other communists and fellow travelers. Writer Mary McCarthy observed that the purpose of these hearings was not to combat subversion, but to convince Americans to accept the principle of betrayal as a norm of good citizenship. Journalist I.F. Stone condemned the tendency to turn a whole generation of Americans into stool pigeons. Many refused to testify and were blacklisted, fired, or jailed. More than 100 college and university teachers were fired for refusing to cooperate with anti-communist investigations. Dashiell Hammett, one of Hollywood's leading writers, was incarcerated for refusing to name contributors to the Civil Rights Congress's bail bond fund, of which he was an honorary trustee. Writer Lillian Hellman later disclosed that Hammett did not know the name of a single contributor, but would not say so in court because he denied the government's right to demand such information. In 1947, the so-called Hollywood Ten were charged with contempt of Congress, and despite a series of appeals to both the judicial system and the public, were sentenced to a year in prison. Along with another 9 Hollywood radicals who had also been subpoenaed by HUAC in 1947, but never called to the stand, the 10 became the first victims of a film industry blacklist. Other high-profile Hollywood progressives joined those 19 on the blacklist. HUAC returned to investigating the film industry in 1951, and by 1954, the blacklist had increased to include 212 men and women who had refused to cooperate with the committee. No studio would hire blacklisted screen artists or studio workers. Many were left jobless. Only 10% of the people driven out of the film industry ever found work there again. A number of individuals, however, escaped that fate by informing on their colleagues. 58 of the 110 men and women called before HUAC in the spring of 1951 named names. By the time all was said and done, McCarthyism had decimated the U.S. left. The communist movement was destroyed. The party itself endured, but many of the groups in and around it simply vanished. The Red Scare eviscerated the labor unions, political organizations, and cultural associations that had spurred the reforms of the 1930s and 1940s. With the exception of the civil rights and anti-nuclear movements, left-wing dissent and progressive reform would remain quiescent for more than a decade, but would reemerge with new vigor and fresh approaches in the 1960s. The labor movement, however, would never recover, leaving American workers weaker and less well off in many respects than their European counterparts. the African-American civil rights movement suffered as well. Under the intense anti-radical pressure of the era, organizations ousted leftist members, some of whom had been long leaders in the fight for racial justice. In 1948, the NAACP went so far as to expel civil rights pioneer W.E.B. Du Bois for actively supporting Henry Wallace's presidential campaign, and for calling the United Nations to address racism in the United States. Paul Robeson was similarly marginalized. Many of the left-wing organizations eliminated by McCarthyite attacks were those that had linked the issues of class-based inequality and U.S. foreign policy with domestic racism. Red-baiting also dissolved alliances between civil rights organizations and labor unions, diminishing the calls for racial equality on the parts of the unions, and isolating the civil rights organizations from battles over wages and workplace rights. In the wake of McCarthyism, the movement's most influential leaders departed from past broad-based agendas to focus on achieving narrower legal reforms, abandoning the drive for deeper structural reforms of the economy or attacks on the ravages of imperialism abroad. It is important to remember, though, that throughout the period, African Americans played a leading role in efforts to halt the nuclear arms race and make sure that Americans never lost sight of the dangers of nuclear war. Individual radicals and movements for social, economic, and racial justice were not the only victims of the mid-20th century scourge of political repression. Concomitant with the Red Scare was a Lavender Scare, in which homosexuals were purged from the federal government. Under the guise of national security, ostensibly because sexual perverts were particularly susceptible to blackmail by foreign and domestic subversives, government agencies fired gays and lesbians or forced them to resign. Historian David Johnson estimates that as many as 5,000 federal employees might have lost their jobs in the early Cold War. In 1953, Undersecretary of State Donald B. Lurie told a congressional committee that in his department alone, dismissals of homosexuals were proceeding at an average rate of about one every day. Those numbers account only for a portion of the jobs lost to the Lavender Scare. The reason for dismissals was sometimes not recorded, supposedly to save the employee from embarrassment. Others chose to resign before their sexual orientation was uncovered. Additionally, thousands of people applying for federal jobs were rejected on the basis of their sexual orientation. As with the Red Scare, the anti-homosexual purge extended to the private sector. Some businesses even hired professional investigators to ferret out undesirables, including gays and lesbians. Throughout those years, the FBI was busy on a number of fronts. It fanned the flames of anti-communist hysteria by leaking information to its assets in the press, including the likes of Walter Winchell, Drew Pearson, Westbrook Pegler, Fulton Lewis Jr., and the Washington bureau chiefs of the United Press and Chicago Tribune. Its program to alert employers as to the political affiliations of their employees cost hundreds of people their jobs. People with dissenting views were subjected to surveillance on a massive scale. By 1960, the FBI had begun investigations of more than 430,000 individuals and groups. The 26,000 considered the greatest risks in 1954, predominantly members of the Communist Party, made it onto Hoover's Security Index, which designated them for detention in the event of an emergency. And in 1956, the FBI launched its counterintelligence program, or COINTELPRO, a panoply of dirty tricks designed to disrupt left-wing organizations engaged in completely legal and constitutionally protected activities. On June 24, 1950, North Korea invaded South Korea, and the Cold War suddenly turned red hot. Nestled between Japan, China, and the Soviet Union, Korea had long been a point of contention among those three Asian powers. Japan had occupied and ruled Korea from 1910 to 1945, when it was divided into a Soviet zone north of the 38th parallel and a U.S. zone to the south. Drawn up hastily by Colonel Dean Rusk the day after Nagasaki was bombed, the arrangement was meant as a temporary one, until unification and independence could be restored. In the north, the Soviets installed General Kim Il-sung, who had led guerrilla forces against the Japanese in Manchuria during the war. The Americans installed Syngman Rhee in the south. Border skirmishes occurred frequently. The Joint Chiefs had warned repeatedly against getting drawn into a war in Korea, a place of little strategic importance bordering on the Soviet Union and China, and recommended that it be excluded from the United States' defense perimeter. Acheson also excluded Korea in an important speech in January 1950, leading some critics to charge that he had deliberately invited the attack. The Soviets watched nervously as the United States strengthened Japan economically and militarily, stationed troops on Japanese territory, and inched toward a peace treaty without Soviet participation. The chiefs cautioned that excluding the Soviets from the peace treaty might provoke a Soviet attack on Japan. The Soviets struck instead in Korea. Rhee's repressive policies and economic blunders made him a very unpopular figure in South Korea. Under U.S. pressure, he allowed elections to proceed in 1950.